Hello and welcome to today's episode of The Insider, brought to you, as ever, by Vanishing Ink. My guest today is the co-founder of Vanishing Ink. He's published more amazing magic books than probably anybody else. He also happens to be a magician. It's Andy Gladwin. Andy, how are you this afternoon?
Hello, I'm very good. I'm in the Rhapsody Theatre in Chicago. We had our opening night last night, and I am tired, but I am happy.
Look, you can't start with the plug. I've got plugs. Carefully woven in through delicately honed segues. You can't just start and plug, Gladwin.
How many seconds do I have to tell you my origin story?
Nick, we've done your origin story at least three times. We're not doing your origin story today. Let's talk about putting on a show, which is something you're experiencing right now, as you're about to do your second night at the Rhapsody Theatre in Chicago. More on that later. See, I crafted it all, man.
I'm not the pro. You're the pro.
How do you create a show? So you're booked to do a show. What happens then? What's the process? What comes first? The name of the show? The story arc? Some tricks? What happens?
What comes first is a whole lot of panicking, is the truth. I knew I was going to do this show maybe 6 months before I did the first run of it. And I started telling myself, like, these are the tricks I kind of would like to do. These are the tricks from my repertoire that I think would fit well in a show. But then I realized, well, there's no real narrative. I don't want to just come and do a load of tricks. That's not a show. That's a collection of tricks. So I spent a lot of time thinking. And it's rare nowadays that I get a chance to just sit in an empty room and think. And I did it, like, I forced myself, you need to come up with a narrative and a format. And it started with an idea that Josh had for a show of his, actually. He wanted to, I don't know whether Josh plans to use this eventually, but he wanted to print a deck of cards for everybody. And when they come to the show, they would get a deck and he would do stuff with that. And I thought, that's a cool idea. And Josh had said before, I'm not sure if I'm going to do this. If you ever want it, feel free. And I liked it, but it wasn't quite where I wanted to go and what I wanted to be. Because I love to improvise. I love crowd work. I love just playing in the moment. And I've always wanted to get better at it. So the more I thought about it, the more I thought, what if people actually brought decks of cards to the show? And now I get to create an improvised magic show, semi-improvised since we're amongst friends. And that, as soon as I had the concept, that then started to open things up for me. From there, I try and start from the outside in. What is the opening effect? What is the closing effect? And what do we need to do to build from the opening and to the closing to meet in the middle? And I can talk about my process for that. But basically, it was a lot of hard work until I got the format. And that really then just opened up all the doors.
I've had, as you're probably aware, several very creative magicians on the show before. And several people have said that limiting something increases the possibilities. So the fact that you'd limited it to borrowed cards that the audience brought, did that then start sparking creativity because you knew you had those boundaries? Or was that more challenging?
No, the great thing about boundaries is it doesn't tell you only where you can go, it tells you where you can break rules. So the boundary is a line in the sand, but that doesn't mean you can only go in one direction from that line. It means you can cross the line in either way. So there are two tricks in the show that use my deck, the first two tricks. But we get to use those as an illustration of what's to come, and it makes it harder because I have to justify why I'm using my own cards. And technically, those two tricks could be done with borrowed decks, but we need to work towards something. If it's just a show that is a load of tricks with people's borrowed cards, again, that's just a collection of tricks. And a big part of what I'm trying to do is create a narrative through this show. And I have two ways of doing that. One is there is more narrative content in the show than you would expect. And you know me more than probably every other listener of this. And so you'll be shocked to know that, like, I talk about feelings in this show, and I talk about my past, and There's kind of a lot of heart in this show in ways that I guarantee that you won't expect. And actually, I've not told Josh about anything that's in the show. And he's going to come and see the final night on this run. And I think he's going to be genuinely shocked at how much heart is in the show, because I am a cold, emotionless Brit. But I've really made it my effort to put the truth in this show. So, to answer your question, yes, it does help me knowing that the format is to use borrowed decks, but it does mean I have to think about that a lot more than just throwing a few tricks together. So just to finish, to close the loop I was talking about, there's two ways of the narrative. One is that the structure of the show, the through line, but the other one is I'm trying to build a narrative with the decks that people have brought with them. So all throughout the show, I'm trying to pick up on people's decks in a way that I can include them in the end of the show as well. And without giving too much away, that actually becomes a little bit difficult because every night it is different. And it's not just a trick that I'm working towards. I'm trying to do callbacks to those cards, which means I have to remember the cards. I have to remember the people's names. I have to remember the cards they selected. And yeah, there's a lot going on in my head during the show to try and create like that structure.
90-minute multiple selection routine where you have to remember everything, but for 90 minutes. But you say about narrative.
Strange way.
You say about narrative. Let's talk about the writing process. How do you write, and when do you involve friends and colleagues?
Great question. So this show is interesting for me because it's the first time I've worked with a non-magician director, and that has been very eye-opening. So I started by writing the scripts as I wanted it to be. And that was more kind of heart and emotion than I would normally give away in a show. Then I read it to some friends. I specifically kept Josh out of the loop of this one, which is weird because we partner on everything like this. But there was a reason for it. It's because I wanted to make sure I was writing and creating a magic show that was about me. And so I got as little input as possible from close friends. So normally I would be calling on Luke Jamay and Josh, and I would be giving them the script and saying, help me punch this up. And I might be giving it to Harrison Greenbaum, as I did with an earlier version of the show, and say, could you help me write some jokes for these moments? And Harrison wrote some incredible jokes, but I learned a lesson that actually they didn't play for me because they are jokes that Harrison would use in a show. And they just didn't work for me. And that's nothing on Harrison. Like, Harrison did an incredible job, but I had to think really carefully about which jokes to use that he suggested. So then the next stage was I read the script to my non-magician director, and she said, I don't believe you. I listened to the script and I don't believe you. Like, I believe that what you are saying is what you believe to be true, but you need to dig a little deeper in this because there is more. That the reason you told me you did this thing, and I'm trying to be coy in case people come see the show, the reason you did this thing, like, that sounds like a surface level reason you did it, but there's more to it. And by keep pushing me in that way of going, I don't believe what you're saying, it's not enough, it really helped me pull out some things that I needed to talk about in the show for the show to make sense.
That sounds almost like a psychiatrist
genuinely
helping you.
I joked, it was like magic therapy. Now, this is not a deep show by any means. Like, I'm not suggesting, like, I've used emotions and feelings a few times. It's like nobody's crying in this show, but it is a journey. It talks about a journey that I went through to get to the point where I am on this stage. And the journey is, you know, basically quitting my job to become a magician. But it starts way sooner in my life than that. So it was just good to have somebody I didn't know sit there and basically question me for the good of the show. And so I found that really useful. Right. And then after that, there were some line edits and stuff that we had to work on and make things funnier. And that's a daily process as I'm running the show.
I know you worked in some of the routines in comedy and magic clubs in the UK before you went out to America. How did that process work? Did you contact venues and say, I've got a show, can I come on and do a 10 spot, or what happened?
So the first iteration of the show, which was last November, was really troublesome in some way because it was an 80-minute show. I hadn't done a single one of those tricks for a live audience, and that is a scary thing to do. It just so happened that my local magic club, which at the time I wasn't a member of, but I have since joined, they were doing a public show. And as soon as I saw that advertised, the day before I left for Chicago, saw it advertised, I was like, hello, can I come and do some magic in your show? And they were so kind, which is why I joined the club. And they were like, well, it's already a long show, but it sounds like you need 30 minutes. So we'll give you 30 minutes on the show. And they moved stuff around for me. And it was like, you know, with 3 hours to go, basically, I went and did the show. And I did some of the tricks on the show. And I'll be honest, but they weren't great. And I was very, very worried. But that was, it gave me enough information to start working through the routines in my own head. Like now I had something to go off. Right. And I should have worked these tricks in way more, if I'm honest. But as you know, I have quite a busy life. And to try and find the time is kind of tricky. But I wish I gave it more time. But every show to me is a lesson. And every show I have from last night's show, I have 5 pages of notes that I sat and made, watched the video back. And so the next show is in 3 hours' time. But my next 3 hours will be running through every one of those notes and trying to get them up here so that they stay.
Sure. Talking of reviewing the shows, I know that the November run, you had them recorded so you could watch them back. Can you talk about that review process of when you're watching it back from a camera sat at the back of the room? What's going through your head and what's your process?
First 5 minutes, I hate my life. Mm-hmm. Truly, I think I look fat. I think I look scruffy. I think I sound awful. I like, you just go through all that process. And once you start to remove all of those thoughts from your heads and start really honing in on what the audience are doing, because the great thing is with having a camera at the back of the room, normally it's elevated because it's on a balcony or something, is you can see what the audience are, how the audience are reacting. So there's a new trick in this run of the show that to me felt pretty flat last night. But it got the best reaction. It got like the longest applause. It was like a 20-second applause. And that was really interesting to me because I actually was considering cutting the trick, but I watched it back and it got a great reaction. But not only has that told me to keep the trick, it's told me to invest more in the trick tonight. So to sell it more. Because I'm a typical Brit. When I get applause, I don't react all that well to it. You know, I'm kind of like shy away from it. But watching a trick like that is going to really allow me to, watching it back is going to allow me to hold the applause longer and to feel more confident in the trick as it's unfolding. Another thing I noticed was I stood out of the light a few times. And in a show like this, it's quite easy to do because I'm running around the audience quite a lot of the time. And I have certain spots I need to hit, but I didn't hit those perfectly. And the big one is at the end of the show, I was so British. The applause came, and there's a, you know, the lights go down, and then they're supposed to come back up. So I then take the bow. The applause comes, the lights go down, light comes back up, and I basically run off stage because I'm like, oh, I don't want all of this. No, I don't need these reactions. So having a video is awful. I hate it. I think one thing I would... So George is not here right now. George, last time was running the show. George will be here in a day or so. And having a friend like George to sit and watch the show with actually is really helpful because you get to laugh at yourself. You don't hate yourself so much. But also you get to talk through things. So there are things that when I watched the video, I didn't quite like. But when like the tech crew here watched, they go, actually, that's better than you think it is. And here's why. And okay. So it's much easier as a collaborative experience.
So you talked about 20 seconds of applause for the trick that you didn't think worked. Have you got, when Harrison was on previously, he was talking about laughs per minute and he audio records most of his shows and will listen to them from going from one gig to New York to the next one and check the laughs per minute. Have you got a spreadsheet? Are you looking, so Saturday night, 20 seconds applause for that trick, 10 seconds applause for that trick, or is it just, you're just thinking, but it's just in your head?
It's just in my head. Like I am a big note taker, but and I'm a big data guy, as you know. But I'm not during a show. To me, it's about feeling. Okay. So there's an opening monologue. It's about 5 or 6 minutes long, and I watched it back, and I'm really looking there for the laughs. Like it felt actually unbalanced last night that there were a lot more laughs towards the end of the story than at the start of the story. So tonight I'm going to be editing a big chunk of the story out, the start, so that we can get the laughs more concentrated. But to me, because I'm not a comedian, the most important thing is that I get the story across in the clearest possible way. So I don't want to be counting laughs, but they do help tell the story. They think it's a funny story, so it needs to have laughs. But to me, it's about feeling, it's about heart. It's not so much about the stats for one point in my life. It's not about stats, it's just about about feel.
Gut.
Gut, yeah.
Talking of Mysterious George, do you want the question that he sent me in?
Yeah, okay. I bet it's something like, what have you changed in the show?
Ask about the rising cards that was in the first run. Plenty of stories of trying and failing there.
Yeah. So I always knew I wanted to close the show with a rising card because it's a trick I love and I've never performed, and what a great opportunity to perform it. Luke Gemmes, one of my close friends, and he's been working on a rising card that is incredible. And I've been part of the process of creating this trick. That's not to take any credit for it, but Luke would send versions and he would go, what do you think? Can I change this? We were talking through it a lot. So that rising card became a big part of my life, actually, because Luke is an absolute addict when it comes to working on tricks like that. And halfway through the process, he said, I know you're looking for a rising card, so if you want this rising card for your show, like, it's yours, you're welcome to use it. So I felt pretty good. I felt great, actually, that like I have this killer trick that I've seen Luke do, and it's the most amazing rising card. You saw it at the session. What an incredible rising card, right? And then about 2 weeks before the show, it was the last trick I had to work on, and I thought, well, I should finally practice this rising card. And it turns out it didn't work in my setting. I don't want to give too much away about Luke's routine, but there were some staging differences that meant that rising card didn't work. So I started playing with it, and I cut it up, and it became a rising card, nothing like Luke's, sadly. But it didn't get a great reaction. It was very different to Luke's. Luke's is a 3 rising card. Mine was a 1 rising card. And every night we played, and every night something went wrong with it. The thread would snap. I would set the cards up wrong. Some of the secret sauce behind it, it didn't quite work. The timing was wrong. And so in all of the shows last run, I think we got 1 that I was actually happy with. Most of the time it looked good. There was a backup. So if the card didn't rise, I would focus my energy elsewhere and something else would happen. But it was always a compromise. And it was during just before this run, or between the 2 runs, I should say, I decided it's got to go. If it's not great, it's not staying. And so it was removed. And I've gone back to kind of where I originally thought this show would end. I've taken a step back. But you know what's interesting is I've taken a part of the opening of the show and put it on the end of the show, and it's now getting a much bigger reaction. So the new ending kind of was snipped out of the old opening. And I think it's here to stay. It's going to take work, but I think it's here to stay.
That's so weird, because you would have thought that an opener's an opener, that it's, you know, punchy, short, establishes yourself. But to move that to the opposite end of the show and it plays stronger.
So the opening of the show is, so it's a multiple selection routine, which is weird because most people close with a multiple selection, but it's a multiple selection, but then with 2 kind of very new style beats after it. I'm really proud of this trick. It's of all the multiple selections I've ever done, this is the one I love the most. And so it used to be find all of the cards and then boom, find the last card in a big way, then boom, surprise ending, and then boom, another surprise ending on top of that. But what I did is I took the final surprise ending, and that's now at the end of the show, completely reworked, but the concept was taken from the opening and put in the end. And so now we have an immediate through line, and it works better. It's not perfect yet. We've only done 1 night. Last night was our opening night. So there's work to do, but I think it's going to stay. I think I finally am getting the feeling that I want for that trick.
What are you most proud of about the show?
That I'm doing it. Because it was very, very tough to get this show on the road. The hours I work for Vanishing Ink and for other things I do. And I called Josh, I think, 2 or 3, maybe 2 months before the first run. And I said, you know what? I think I'm going to have to pull out. Like, I am not getting the time to work on these tricks. I'm not getting the time to rehearse. I'm not getting the time to perform, as you heard earlier. I don't think this show is going to be ready. And his response was, I think you might be right. Like, some people have a life where they can work on a new 80, 90 minutes of magic. Some people don't, and you haven't found a way. I have family and I have commitments outside of magic, and it was looking like I should cancel. And I called George and I told George that George was getting a free ship trip to Chicago. So he was like, absolutely not. Like, if you cancel, then you have just accepted you will never, ever get the show finished. Like, you've got to do the show. And he was right. I had to do the show. It was very hard. I was very, very stressed. Like, my face was physically twitching for the 2 or 3 weeks before the show. Like, I was that stressed. Like, it just took over my whole body. And I pushed myself more than I should have. But now that I'm here on the second run, and now that I have a show that I'm starting to become proud of, and that I can see that's going to be in the direction I want it to be in, I'm so glad I did it. But did I have to fight to get it done?
If people wanted to do a formal close-up show, how do they? Did the venue approach you? Do you approach the venues? Could you? Yeah. What would somebody do if they wanted to do a formal close-up?
Again, I have it in easy mode, right? I have a lot of great friends, great contacts. Ricardo Rosencrantz, who's the owner of this theater, is a friend of mine. And I happened to be here for one of the opening nights, one of the first nights when he opened the theater. And because I was doing a lecture in Chicago, and it just worked out perfect timing. And he invited me to see the theater. And he said, if you ever want to do a show here, you let me know and I'll book you immediately. So it was easier for me. As to what I would do is, I would learn from what I didn't do, which is get as much stage time as possible. And that doesn't matter whether you're performing for £5, $10 or whatever in an open mic night. Just get on stage as much as you can and get this material worked in. Then put the show on yourself. Like, you don't need a big theater like this to back you. There are no gatekeepers when you do it yourself. If there are six people in the audience, there are six people. At least you're getting the show done. So I would say, just get it done. You know, just do it, to use the Nike.
Even I don't know what the equivalent of a function room in the back of a pub is in America, but just
they
that
exist.
Kind of
I've
thing.
Lectured in them. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So just that sort of just go and find a space and say, can I put on the show?
Exactly. You know, the old Steve Martin quote, be so good they can't ignore you. Right. So just get great. And then the opportunities come. And I am sure, I don't actually know how a theater like this works for new acts. I think it's mostly they listen out for great acts who are a fit for them. But I'm sure they would accept submissions. If I didn't know anybody who worked in this theater, I would have found a way to get to them. You know, I would have sent a video. I would have filmed the show and sent a video to them. Or I would have invited them to a show I'm doing nearby. Like, there's always a way. You just have to be willing to do it. And actually, a lot of times when I get emails about those kind of questions from people, I've started replying with now, it sounds like you're looking for someone to give you permission to start this work. And actually, people are responding more and more positively to that, because I think that's really what it is. You know, I'm trying to put together a show, but I don't know whether I should do this or this. And I just always say, it sounds like you're looking for permission to start your show. Like, I'm not the person to give you that, but I'm saying, go and do it. Like, just start the work. So, that's to me is the answer. If you want to put on a show, put on a show. Don't let anyone stop you. Be so good they can't ignore you.
Now, the premise of the show about people bringing along cards, there must have been a couple of amusing, funny, weird. I'm trying to cue you for funny card anecdote. But there must have been some weird decks. What was the weirdest or the funniest or the most difficult to work with or the most unusual? Have you had one with nudie ladies on?
I know what you would bring. So, yes, and a part of it is trying to understand the audience. We did a late night show last run, which allowed me to be a bit more flexible with that. So one lady brought three decks of naked men cards. Not one, okay. But three. And so I did Card to Fly, for example, with that.
Okay.
But I wouldn't, there's no way I would do that in a normal show. And if that lady was in the 7 p.m. show tonight, I would almost certainly either ignore those cards or make a joke that is like, well, I'm not going anywhere near those. Like, there's a family show, whatever.
So is it like looking around for a watch steal? Are you looking at the cards that people have on the tables and thinking, no way, I'm not touching that? Or Uno deck, I've got a joke about an Uno deck I could do or whatever.
Absolutely that. So there's two parts of it. Basically three parts. The first one is I'm looking for decks that I can make funny. Last night, somebody brought a deck of cards of pictures of terrorists, like the America's Most Wanted deck. So I deliberately don't pre-write jokes for those kinds of cards, but I'm looking to see what I can make funny with that. And I'm also, kind of to let you in the process here, I'm looking for what is a joke I can make now and what is a joke I can make later in the show about that deck. Because I want to be able to call back throughout the show for it. So there's that. I'm also looking for decks that I can do tricks with that make sense for that deck. But I'm also looking at the spectator too. Last night there was this really cute little girl. She must have been 8 years old, came running up to me with her deck, which is the first time that's ever happened in the show. But she was wearing like a hat, like a witch's style hat. So I did card in, I made her card appear in her hat. Last night, somebody gave me a deck that was mixed face up, face down. I'm automatically doing the Tamarisk thing. Mixed face up, face down. And so I did Triumph with his deck. But now it's the most logical Triumph ever because I spread through and I say, well, your cards are all mixed up. I can't do a trick with this. Did you deliberately
cull, 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 cull.
Exactly, yeah. Making conversation while I'm culling. Like, did you know that? And he was like, no. I was like, okay, well, why don't you sort these cards out? Oh, no, wait. I'll sort them out for you. We'll speed this up. And then I change them. And now I can do a trick.
That's brilliant.
Something else that happened last night. And by the way, these are all things that have only happened last night. None of these things happened in the previous run, which is really exciting, actually, because it means tonight, different things. I do a thought of cards across, and the card was the Ace of Diamonds. And the woman next to the person who thought the card said, I thought of the Ace of Diamonds, too. And so, like, now I've opened up an opportunity. So now I say, I said, oh, weird. Did you bring a deck? Did you bring? And I pick up her deck and cull, Ace of Diamonds. Where did you get these cards from? And she said, oh, I got them from the dollar store. And now I'm back on stage at this point with her card palmed. I got this deck from the dollar. I've got the same deck. I bought it from the dollar store, but it was cheap. The cards weren't great, so I trashed all of the cards. But I kept one card. It's the Ace of Diamonds. And actually, you can keep this one. Now you have two Ace of Diamonds, and I give it back. And I watched the video back last night. I was so proud of myself.
Did you hide it?
No, I didn't. And actually, that's one of my notes for myself. Is actually, I don't want to hide it. I want to be like, oh, come on. I'm pleased with that. Like, that's just a few things that happen. But when you're inviting people in, like always cool stuff happens like that. You just have to be prepared to do it. And so, like, one of the things I was thinking about is there's essentially nothing to stop other magicians doing this kind of show. When you hear about the generic, it's a deck with other people. It's a show with other people's decks. But actually, that's not what this show is. It's a show with other people's decks, but it's an improvised magic show. It's a comedy show using their deck. It's a lot deeper than just a bring cards along and I'll do it. A show with it. So I'm looking for jokes, but I'm also looking for tricks, basically. And then I'm looking for anything that I can use as a through line as well. So lots going on, but I'm loving doing it.
Sounds hectic. When is this run? Where is it? And where can people get tickets, Andy?
It is at the Rhapsody Theatre in Chicago, which is an amazing theatre in Rogers Park in Chicago. We are here for another 2 weeks, which I don't know what the dates are. Let's have a look. I'll tell you what the dates are. The last show
we are recording on the 15th of March for people listening.
And the last show is on the 24th. There are three shows on Saturdays. There are, I think, one or two shows on the other days, mostly one show. So there is still an opportunity. But because it is a close-up kind of parlor show, it's limited to, I think, 60 seats per show. And already ticket sales are looking like we're going to be healthy. So if you want to come and see me, grab your ticket now.
We always end the show with four quick-fire questions, Andy Gladwin. And
you've
done the show three or four times before, so I've customized the four questions for you. And Dustin Grimm, who's watching live, said that he was looking for, and Joshua Crompton's there. Joshua, hello. He said he's been looking forward to the Tiny Josh's Giant Andy question, but we'll see where we go with that. Chicago is quite famous for pizza. Your favorite pizza top, deep dish Chicago pizza. That's a thing. That wasn't even a joke. What's your favorite pizza that you've had whilst you've been in Chicago? Have you had one yet?
Okay. The thing I was laughing at is because you were like, I've got original questions, and then you're answering the same questions.
Oh, no, it's all the same questions. I've just added Chicago on the end. Yeah, you'll see this as we go through quite quickly.
Obviously, the standard deep dish margarita. I'm a vegetarian, but the tomato and cheese and the crazy thick filling in a Chicago deep dish is insane. Highly recommend it.
What's your favorite movie that you've seen whilst you've been in Chicago?
I haven't watched any movies in Chicago. I've been too busy.
Okay. What's the favorite music that you've listened to whilst you've been in Chicago?
You cut out. Sorry, you'll have to do it again.
Oh, the favorite music that you've listened to whilst you've been in Chicago?
That is a great question. I actually do have an album I was just listening to. Hang on, I can't even remember the actual name. Here we go. Stick Season by Noah Kahan, I guess it is. There's a song called Stick Season that has become kind of the soundbite of my trip. It's a really a nice, chill song.
And finally, the favorite giant person you'd prefer to fight than 100 tiny yous whilst in Chicago?
Should we say George, since I think he's basically the only person I know in Chicago?
Yeah, that's fine. You could have just picked, you know, one of the crew. But if you want to fight George, that's fine.
All right, I'll fight George.
Andy Gladwin, thank you very much for your time. Andy's show, you've heard the dates, book tickets, and book tickets, go and see the show. It's Andy Gladwin. That's the end. It's a wrap. Thank you.
Goodbye, everybody.